You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. We will, in the second and third hour of our program, and our Anything Goes Friday, I will share with you my observations and thoughts of Mr. Romney's speech last night and all things political and everything that's been going on. But, of course, for the first hour of our Friday program, our national town hall meeting, your opportunity to talk to a United States senator and say whatever is on your mind, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, to give us a call. Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie segment. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom, and welcome back to you as well. How are you feeling?
Thank you. I'm feeling better. I had the surgery, and then something went wrong, and I ended up in the ER for 4 days, and it got very messy. And, boy, I've learned more about – it was my first time ever in the hospital. I've learned more about hospitals than I ever want to know the rest of my life. But I'm getting better now.
That's not a good way to learn about health care, Tom.
No, it's
not. There are better ways. So I have some good books for you.
Yeah. The number one thing I learned is that get to know the nurses. They know everything. So – anyhow, a lot been going on over the last week politically in the United States. I'm curious your take on the week.
Okay, obviously there's a lot that's going on. We've had the Republican convention and Democrats do their convention next week. I think what strikes me, Tom, is the degree to which the Republican Party has moved to the far right. You know, the Republican Party used to be what we'd call a center-moderate party. But it has really, and sadly and tragically for this country, become a right-wing extremist party. And I know in the state of Vermont, for many, many years, we had Republican governors, Republican senators, and virtually none of those guys who were kind of moderate Republicans could feel at home today in the Republican Party of 2012. I suspect that somebody like President Dwight David Eisenhower would not be accepted, given his politics, into the Republican Party today, has become a very right-wing party. Let me just give you some examples, just to make sure that the listeners have a sense of how far to the right the Republicans have gone. The issue of abortion has, you know, been debated in this country for a very, very long time. I am strongly pro-choice. But I think what people should know, in the Republican Party plank passed at this convention, what they have said is that if a woman is raped, and this is a constitutional amendment that they want to pass, see passed. Right. If a woman is raped, she must have the rapist baby, even at the expense of her own life. No exclusions. Even right. If the woman is ill, she must have the rapist baby. I mean, I think that it's just very, very hard for me to understand how rational people could come up with a conclusion like that. We're talking in terms of the environment and global warming. I am on both the Environment and Energy Committees in the Senate, and we talk to scientists quite often. The overwhelming, well over 90% of scientists who have written peer-reviewed literature on global warming believe, A, global warming is real, B, that it is significantly caused by human activity, and C, that it is causing significant harm to our country and to the world right now. If the Republicans gain control of the Senate, and there is a real chance that that could happen unless we mobilize and prevent that, the gentleman who will be chairman of the Environmental Committee is Jim Inhofe, a senator from Oklahoma. Jim believes that global warming is a hoax perpetrated on the American people by Al Gore, the Hollywood elite, and the United Nations.
Wow.
This is the guy who would have oversight responsibilities for the U.S. Senate in dealing with global warming.
That is not a good thing. Did we just... We just lost Senator Sanders. Do we have a backup telephone line? Looks like he's on the phone right now. Okay. I'm sorry. We've got all this wonderful technology here, but sometimes things fail, and we'll get Bernie back on the line. He was just talking about how Jim Inhofe, Senator James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, would be in charge of our environment in the Senate if the Republicans take they only have to take 3 seats in the United States Senate. And this is why this election is so critically important, is so incredibly critically important. And they're redialing the Telos also, right? Shane? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna get this thing working here. We're gonna get Bernie back with us. But and by the way, fact checking Mitt Romney's acceptance speech. I want to get. Hang on just a second. Oh, we have Bernie back. Bernie, you're there?
Yeah.
Oh, my apologies.
Okay.
Technology bit us.
Hey, Tom.
Okay. You were saying Jim Inhofe is going to be in charge of things, and
thinks that... But if the Republicans gain control over the Senate, Jim Inhofe, who believes that global warming is a hoax perpetrated on the American people by Al Gore, the Hollywood elite, and the United Nations, he will be chairman of the committee that deals with global warming in the United States Senate.
Right.
Thirdly, when you talk about right-wing extremism in the Republican Party, what these guys want to do is, at a time when we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country, where the top 1% now owns more wealth than the bottom
90%, and the gap is growing wider, what they want to do is give huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, and then they want to cut back on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This party, this right-wing extremist party, strongly supports the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which says that a corporation is a person. I can understand why they support it, because if you look at what was happening in Tampa, they have all these billionaires coming to their convention, and we have reached the stage where, according to one study at least, we have just a handful of individuals who are prepared to spend huge amounts of money in the political process. So I guess if you're a Republican, you think that that's good, despite what it may mean to American
Well, they put it in their platform that they stand behind Citizens United and that they want the rest of McCain-Feingold repealed.
Right. We have a situation today, according to one study, where 47 wealthy people, have contributed 42% of the money in this year's presidential election.
Wow.
42. So, you know, in a sense, what you're seeing, and you saw it on display, I think, at the Republican convention, where apparently there was a yacht there for all these guys, which flew the flag of the Cayman Islands, appropriately enough, which is a huge tax haven for these guys. And you have, you know, the Koch brothers putting $400 million into this campaign. You have Sheldon Adelson putting $100 million into this campaign. So you got multi-billionaires who say, hey, you know, I own all kinds of companies, and now for a modest investment, think about it, I can own a good part of the United States government. Pretty good investment for them. So I think the point to be made is that anyone who thinks that this is their father's or grandmother's Republican Party is sorely mistaken. This is now a right-wing extremist party. People who want to give tax breaks to billionaires, cut back on programs for the elderly, the children, the sick and the poor, the most vulnerable people in this country. So this is an election of huge, huge consequence, and we've got to get to work and make sure that we don't end up the day after the election with Mitt Romney as president and with Republicans controlling the Senate and the House.
Yeah, and more of them to be on the Supreme Court, too, as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So this, I think, is probably why there were no details in Mitt Romney's speech last night.
Right, that's right. I mean, and not only were there no specific details about what they proposed to do, because the truth of the matter is what the economic agenda they have is nothing more than George W. Bush's old agenda, and that is more tax breaks for billionaires, more unfettered free trade so that more companies can move more quickly to China and other low-wage countries, more deregulation of Wall Street and other large corporations so that...
Hold on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There we go. You can wrap it. Last 5 seconds.
Right. I mean, that's what it is. It's the same old agenda of George W. Bush, which grotesquely failed the American people. That's what they want to bring back.
According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood. Always a big one. For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
Never use a small falsehood, always a big one. That was 1944, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It is our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. And Paul in Leesburg, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I'm a great admirer. You care about the people. My question is, and I know they've denied it, do you see continued attacks upon union members and upon federal workers? Because I feel like I'm constantly under attack for something I had nothing to do with.
Paul.
And this concerted effort to continue attacking unions, Wisconsin, Ohio, so on and so forth. Is it concerted, and is it going to continue?
Well, it depends on who controls our government. If the Republicans do, it will absolutely continue. And it is a concerted effort. It's a concerted effort for a number of reasons. First of all, of what Republicans understand correctly, that in their effort to continue their attacks against working families and cut programs that workers and the elderly and the children need so they can give more tax breaks to billionaires, the main source of opposition are the trade unions of this country. And if you break the unions, that means they could just go marching straight through to the goalposts with nobody there trying to stop them. Second of all, in terms of federal employees, let's be clear. Republicans, the right-wing Republicans of today, basically believe that we should do away, over a period of time, with Social Security. And if you need retirement benefits, you go to Wall Street. We should, over a period of time, do away with Medicare, make savage cuts in Medicaid, and you go to private insurance companies. They do not believe in the Environmental Protection Agency, making sure that our air or water is clean. So if you hold the view that government is an evil, that we should not be providing retirement security in terms of Social Security to the elderly, to widows and orphans, to the disabled, you are going to go after federal employees. You're going to attack the government. You're going to diminish the role and size of government. One way you do that, and they have been doing it, is putting wage freezes on federal employees, making it harder and harder for workers, federal employees to stay on their jobs. Cut back on pensions, for federal employees. So, Paul, it is not your imagination. There is a very concerted and direct attack against the federal government and against, federal, employees.
George in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. Glad to see you back in there swinging, and it's an honor to talk to both you and the senator. I've been thinking that perhaps we do an end around the Republicans' a punitive voter would be next year. The new Congress is amenable to this kind of approach. Why not propose, and perhaps you could do this, Senator, a national voter ID card that would be issued free of charge to every person when they register to vote? The technology is simple and easy. It's just like they have it at the motor vehicle facilities. And it could be funded by federal money, and the states could be told, you can accept this or turn it down, but if you turn it down, you won't get any federal highway money, and the Corps of Engineers won't build any water projects in your state. I mean, this is old-fashioned nuts and bolts politics. But if every voter has a state-issued ID with a picture that says, I am a registered voter, well, then, at least theoretically, that would address the concerns that the Republicans
George,
are raising, and it would ensure everybody's right to vote.
George, I don't know if your solution is the right one, but you're raising a very important issue, and I hope all of the listeners understand that not only do Republicans strongly support Citizens United, which means that billionaires can buy and sell politicians and put unbelievable amounts of money into the current campaign. What they are also doing in many states where we have Republican governors and legislatures is working hard, and this is what George is talking about, in terms of voter suppression. And we've gotten some good decisions recently in Texas overturning what their governor and legislature had done. But I think everybody understands that in the name of fighting voter fraud, they are passing very punitive pieces of legislation which have the very express goal of making it harder for low-income people and older people to vote by not having photo ID. So I don't know that we have to do all that George has suggested. I think all that we have to do is enforce the Voter Rights Act and understand that, fortunately, in this country, voter fraud is not a major problem. It happens very, very infrequently. When it does happen, perpetrators should be severely punished. But our job is to encourage as many people to vote as possible, not to do what the Republicans are trying to do, is to push people off of the voting rolls and make it harder and harder for people to vote, because they detect, they perceive that the only way they're going to win elections is just to keep a lot of people from participating. I think that's a pretty cruddy approach to politics, and I think that undermines everything that any American, regardless of his or her political persuasion, should believe in terms of the political process in this country.
Bernie, one of our callers shared this statistic with me last week or the week before. He said last year, 23 people were arrested and prosecuted for voter fraud. 26 people died because their televisions fell on their heads.
I mean, that is the point. Voter fraud is, in fact, a serious crime, should be punished. It is very, very infrequent in this country, and everybody knows what the Republicans have in mind. I think a few of their own people have actually spilled the beans on this.
Yeah, they have. Absolutely. It's Senator Bernie Sanders with us. I think of him as America's senator. Vermont, of course, knows he's theirs. But for today, he's all of ours, answering your questions here on the Tom Hartman Program on our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can check out ours at tomhartman.com. You can even drop into our free live chat room and say hi to some of the finest minds on earth. Yeah, he's the man, Senator Bernie Sanders, on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Danny in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I was wondering, you know, Paul Ryan talks about saving Medicare, and I was wondering, I mean, it's all the same money. It's not like he's going to find new money, right? And so if it's the same money, how is he talking about saving other than giving you a voucher and just saying, you know, you're on your own? I mean, if he's going to save it and save money, I mean, and it's the same money, I mean, I don't understand that math.
Well, what the math is, this is what their argument is. And they use the same argument, Danny, for Social Security as well. What they say is the only way we can save these programs is to cut these programs. And that's the only way we're going to be able to leave those programs for our kids and our grandchildren. That, unfortunately, is wrong and dishonest. In terms of Social Security, and Paul Ryan is one of those who would like to privatize Social Security and certainly supports cuts in Social Security, what we have to understand is Social Security has not contributed a nickel to the deficit because it is funded by the payroll tax, and B, Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus and can pay out all benefits for the next, I believe, 21 years. So whenever you hear these guys talking about the need to cut Social Security, understand that that is just a very dishonest statement. In terms of Medicare, this is what Ryan has in mind. And, of course, the goal is to cut Medicare and to put more of the burden for health care costs onto the seniors themselves. I mean, everybody understands this. Why do you advocate, why do you talk about Medicare and the need to go forward on deficit reduction if you're not going to cut Medicare? So, of course, that's what they have in mind. And here's what they want to do. What they are saying over a 10-year period, not tomorrow, what they are saying is that if you are 67, 68 years of age, we will give you a check, a voucher, for your health care needs. And I believe the number they're talking about is about $8,000. And with, Danny, with that $8,000 check, you can go out to any private insurance company you want and get the policy that you, the best policy you can. Now, they also want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which protects seniors and anybody else against discrimination because of pre-existing conditions. So here's the story. You are a 67-year-old. You are a 70-year-old senior. You just came back from the doctor who told you you have cancer or some other serious, serious disease. You're going to need a lot of treatment. You're going to need hospitalization. And you go walking into your local insurance company and say, here's my check for $8,000, and I hope that you're going to give me a policy which will treat me, which will help me as I get my cancer treatments or my heart disease treatments. And what is that insurance agent going to say to you? He's going to laugh in your face and say, are you kidding? We're not in the business of helping people. We're in the business of making money. Your $8,000 policy is a loser for us because we're going to have to spend tens of thousands of dollars on you. Why would we in a million years want your business? You know, go to somebody else. We don't want you. Nobody is going to want you. And then the next question is, what happens to that senior citizen with cancer or a heart disease? How do they get the care that they need? Well, two things happen. Number one, you got to go back to figure out how you can get the money. Maybe it's out of your own pocket if you have it. Maybe if you don't, it's your kids if they have it. And if you don't have the money and your kids don't have the money, well, I'll let you finish the end of that story. But it will be a tragedy. So, of course, they want to push the burden of health care onto individual seniors with substantially increased out-of-pocket costs.
Jim in Worcester, Mass., you're on the air with Bernie.
Hi, Jim here from Worcester.
You're on the air,
hey, Jim.
Hello.
Yes,
hello.
Sir.
Oh, hi. First of all, two of the best talk show on our radio and the best senator in the Senate. I have a quick comment and a question about tariffs. I never hear any Democrats ever talking about the fact that when Romney became the governor of Massachusetts, he cut taxes to the tune of $100 million for the corporations, and he raised fees for all the people in Massachusetts to the tune of $100 million, like fishing licenses, registrations for cars, so on and so forth. I never hear anybody talking about that when he claims he cut taxes here.
Well, I think it is very clear, Jim, that for folks like Ryan and Romney, their goal is, despite the fact that we have a grotesquely and growing unequal distribution of wealth and income, we have one family in this country, the Walton family of Walmart, owning more wealth than the bottom 40% of America, where the top 1% now owns something like 41% of the wealth of America, while the bottom 60% owns less than 2%. So we have enormous income and wealth inequality. And what these guys want to do, and if you watch that Tampa convention, the Republican convention there very closely, they got all these billionaires sitting there. And what do the billionaires want? With very few exceptions, they want to lower taxes for themselves and for their corporations. They want to make it easier to put their money in tax havens in the Cayman Island and in Bermuda and elsewhere. And they want to shift the burden of government onto the middle class and working families. It ain't complicated. That's what these guys are putting money into this campaign for. More tax breaks for the rich. The Ryan budget gives huge tax breaks to the rich, increases taxes for the middle class, makes savage cuts in the health care and nutrition programs and educational programs that working families depend upon. That's what the Republican platform is about, and it is not complicated to figure out.
John in Englewood, New Jersey, listening on our New York City blowtorch station, WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. Pleasure to speak with you. Two questions. The first one is, with lobbyists, how do you get rid of this huge, big corporation influence when the very people that have to vote to get rid of it are the ones that are being bought? And the second question is, with logic, you would think that we would just have the smartest people to create new technologies and invest with them. In other words, NASA. They've created technologies that have added trillions, literally trillions of dollars to business in our country. Why not? Why is that so hard for the Republicans to understand?
Well, they understand it very well. You know, John, one thing I want to say about my Republican colleagues, these guys are not dumb, and people very often say, why don't they understand it? Why don't they understand the role the government, as John is saying, has played in spurring technology which benefits them? Don't they understand that if you cut Medicaid and you throw millions of kids off of health insurance, that that is immoral and a wrong thing to do. Don't they understand it? And the answer is they do. It's just not their worldview. It's not just something that they stay up nights worrying about. Their job and their worldview is associated with the very wealthiest people in this country, and they look at the world from their perspective. In terms of lobbyists, what you're talking about is the enormous power that big money plays in our government every single day. And the key issue here is not just Citizens United and the fact that you have individual billionaire families pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into the campaign. It is the fact that they also provide and pay very handsome salaries to lobbyists all over Capitol Hill to fight for their interests. Ultimately, the goal of progressive politics has got to move back to one person, one vote, where billionaires do not have the kind of undue influence they have right now in virtually every major piece of legislation. Go down the list. Tax breaks for the rich, yes. Raising the minimum wage, no. Universal health care, no. But help for the private insurance companies, yes, et cetera, et cetera. What we need to do is not only overturn Citizens United, that disastrous Supreme Court decision, we need to move to public funding of elections to get big money out of the political process. That is one of the most important things that we can do to restore our basic democratic traditions in this country.
Jeremiah in Carraport, Pennsylvania. I hope I'm pronouncing your city's name right, Jeremiah.
Colport.
Okay. Thank you for watching us on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. In order to counter Citizens United, we need good talking points that resonate with the American people. I have some. No tax breaks for outsourcing, no welfare checks for oil companies. We can unite both of these under the bumper sticker slogan, stop the Republican war on the middle class.
Okay, let's get Bernie's thoughts on this. We just have 1 minute till the break.
I think Jeremiah makes a very good point. We have introduced legislation, actually, to do away with all of the subsidies that the fossil fuel industry receives. And Jeremiah is absolutely right in saying that outsourcing is a huge problem. And let me remind the listeners that one of the reasons our middle class is disappearing is that over the last 10 years, we have lost 60,000 factories in this country and millions of decent-paying jobs. And I don't believe you're going to see the kind of economic recovery that we desperately need unless we rebuild manufacturing in this country and demand that corporate America invest in the United States of America and not in China, not in Vietnam. And to do that, you're going to need some significant changes in our trade policies.
It is Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can check out our website at tomhartman.com. Over there you can make your own blogs, participate in the message boards, participate in our chat room. It's all free.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Robert in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
All right. It's a privilege to talk with both of you. However, I have a question regarding the Ryan plan regarding Medicare. I've been told, or I've heard that Ryan has defended it, saying that actually a person would still be able to enroll in traditional Medicare with his new revised plan. Is that accurate? Or
it is, Robert. Under the original Ryan plan that passed the House, my strong understanding is that was not the case. Now they're going to give people the option of staying in traditional Medicare or going with the voucher. The problem is they're going to have to use their $8,000 check to stay in traditional Medicare, and in fact, that may not cover the cost of that program.
Doesn't that set up the same kind of ghettoization, basically, that you have where you have private and public schools competing with vouchers, and the public,
absolutely,
the private schools take all the
sure,
easy to teach kids, and the really hard,
right,
to teach kids end up in the public schools, the really,
well,
sick people would end up on
Medicare?
The sicker
people, exactly, the sicker people will remain on Medicare, the cost of Medicare will go up, people will not be able to afford to stay in Medicare.
Right, and then they could say, okay, we got to kill this program off because it's freaked out, it's not working. Amazing,
right.
Absolutely amazing. Patty in Happy Valley, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Hi, good to talk to you. Thank you for all you do. My question is, with all of the propaganda and pandering to minorities. On the one hand, and on the other hand, they're suppressing voters aimed at minorities. So how do they expect to get votes on their side when they're coming at it like that?
You're talking about the Republican Party here.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think, I think that Republicans and even some of their smart guys understand this, that in the long run, you are not going to be able to survive if you are an overwhelmingly just white party. If your politics kind of makes it clear that you don't have policies that are positive for African Americans, for immigrants, for Hispanics, and they worry about that. The way their antidote is, I suppose, as I understand that Romney is going to be spending a huge amount of money on Hispanic radio and television ads. But I don't think that will work, because I think many Hispanics and certainly African Americans understand what their policies are about. And obviously, from a socioeconomic point of view, many African Americans and Hispanics are at the lower end of the economic spectrum, and they understand that the Republican policies will be devastating to them.
Lee in Trumansburg, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Senator Sanders, I would like to know your opinion on why we still have the Patriot Act, and I guess basically that's it.
Well, you're talking to somebody who voted against the Patriot Act when I was in the House and helped lead the effort against it. You have it because, you have folks in this country who, under the guise of fighting terrorism, and terrorism is a serious issue, we have to be vigilant against terrorism, but under the guise of fighting terrorism, I think, have made a significant attack against the civil liberties and the constitutional rights of the American people. Interestingly enough, Lee, on that issue, you have some conservative folks, people like Ron Paul and I, when I was in the House, working together to understand that, yeah, we've got to be vigorous in fighting terrorism, but you don't have to do it in a way that undermines the Constitution of the United States of America, and we can protect our civil rights and our privacy rights.
Okay. Rich in Sun City, Arizona, watching on Free Speech TV on Dish Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator. My opinion of this is that the American public doesn't seem to recognize that the Republican Party is in the beginning stages of establishing what, according to the dictionary, is a totalitarian government, which is one-party rule, not communism, one-party rule, as expressed by the man that defeated Dick Lugar in Indiana, said, I'm going to Washington to establish permanent control by the Republican Party, as well as the autocratic government that's been established in Michigan in their emergency law. What do you think?
Well, I would look at it a little bit differently, Rich. The way I look at it is that these guys are in the business of working with the billionaires in this country who have been very aggressive in this campaign. We have documented at least 23 billionaire families who are spending at least $250,000 on this campaign. I think that underestimates the degree to which the big money is trying to buy this election. My worry, Rich, is moving toward an I would use the word oligarchic, not totalitarian. And the difference is that in an oligarchic society, What you have is a small number of very, very wealthy families who have not only enormous control over the economy, i.e. Wall Street and many other very large corporate entities, but also over the political process. And what Citizens United is about is giving these people, for the first time, the ability to really own the political process through unlimited campaign contributions. So I think what you may end up with is a Republican Party virtually totally controlled by millionaires and billionaires, and a Democratic Party also heavily influenced by big money. And that's the issue that concerns me very much.
And then a small number of oligarchs are basically running our country. I think we've got about 15 seconds. No, we don't. I'm sorry. We didn't even have that. Bernie, on that note, we'll have to leave it. Thank you so much for being with us again this week.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, Tom. Good
to always, always an honor to have you, Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, you can check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. How about that Clint Eastwood? Hey?
Hey, get off my chair, you young whippersnapper.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you at the second hour of our program. Anything Goes Friday, but commentator or host's privilege here. Before I pick up your phone calls, I just want to offer my thoughts on what I saw last night in the Republican National Convention. I think, there's a lot of stuff that you could get snarky about,
Here's that 82-year-old man yelling, "Stay off my lawn!"
Things like that. But or how many times Mitt Romney has smacked his lips? They got 101 of them apparently over on Daily Kos. They got the video. But that's really not the point. The point is that last night's convention, aside from the things, the Mormons talking about, how Mitt Romney is a good Mormon and what a decent person he is and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that actually, I think, is the kind of stuff that should be in a presidential convention. Who is this guy? But the other half of it should be, what are our policies? What is it that we're going to do? And we heard none of that last night. What we heard were attacks on President Obama that, by and large, were wrong or misleading or just plain old flat-out lies. And we heard vague generalities that amounted to virtually nothing. And for this, Center for American Progress did a nice job of, here's the lies from Romney's speech last night. They're on all the progressive websites. But my first check was the Washington Post. And because, they're really, really trying. I mean, and the Washington Post is owned by a big corporation, too. I mean, this is the corporate media. But they're really trying to say, we're going to pretend that we're actually really journalists now and point out inaccuracies or factual conundrums or whatever the AP was calling them yesterday. I've already forgotten the phrase. It was so obscure. I know I had it. Here we go. Factual shortcuts. Yes. The Washington Post took a tour through Romney's speech last night. And so here's the first one, clip number one, Shane.
"And unlike the president, I have a plan to create 12 million new jobs."
Right. Well, as the Washington Post points out, only two presidents in history have created 12 million new jobs. That would be Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. Both of them took 8 years to do it. And we have no idea what Romney's plan is to do that. Now, we do know that Barack Obama has a jobs plan. He laid it out before Congress. You'll remember, half a year ago or so, he was saying, please pass this jobs plan. Let's put people back to work in this country. This is just simple math. When you spend $1 billion on a road, you generate hundreds of billions of dollars worth of economic activity, which pays back that $1 billion many times over in terms of taxes. When you spend $1 billion on building hospitals or schools or anything that is functional to our society, you know, subways, light rail, rapid transit, when you spend money, you're not actually spending money. You're investing because you're going to get a return on that investment that is greater than the investment itself. And that's why, you know, I get Republicans on and they say, well, you know, what should the president do? And I say he should borrow some more money and he should be investing it in America because the return will pay down the deficit. It's how Dwight Eisenhower did it. It works. So anyhow, but Mitt Romney, here's how the Washington Post put it to his plan. I have a plan to create 12 million new jobs. This sounds like a pretty bold statement, especially considering that only two presidents, Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, created more than 12 million jobs. Romney, in fact, says he can reach this goal in just 4 years through a policy paper issued by his campaign, though the policy paper issued by his campaign contains few details. It is mostly a collection of policy assertions, such as reducing debt, overhauling tax code, fostering free trade, and so forth. But in fact, the number is even less impressive than it sounds. This pledge amounts to an average of 250,000 jobs a month, a far cry from the 500,000 jobs a month that Romney once claimed he would create in a normal, would be created in a normal recovery. By the way, our economy right now is averaging 150,000 jobs a month. So Romney says he's going to do 250. The second Romney lie from last night. Here we go.
I will begin my presidency with a jobs tour. President Obama began his presidency with an apology tour.
This is a particularly vicious lie. Quoting the Washington Post, we tracked down every statement Obama uttered that partisans claim was an apology and concluded that each one had been misquoted or taken out of context. His comments overseas were not much different than those of his predecessor, George W. Bush. Indeed, on several occasions, Bush apologized to foreign governments for action taken by U.S. soldiers, such as the shooting of the Quran or prisoner abuse in Iraq. Despite earning four Pinocchios for this claim for months, Romney keeps repeating it. So we're back to Franklin Roosevelt pointing out that there was this guy who wrote this book once back in the 30s who suggested that you should tell a big lie, not a small one, and repeat it over and over and over again. So what's the next lie? Clip number three.
Does it fail to find the jobs that are needed for 23 million people and for half the kids graduating from college?
Well, actually, half the kids graduating from college is not the number that can't find a job. It's much, much lower than that. I mean, it's still not good. You know, it's in the 20% unemployment range, youth unemployment coming out of college. But it's half of them coming out of college can't find a job in their field. And the Washington Post says, you know, Romney is generally careful to include the phrase underemployment. But in this case, he decided to simply, now, that's quoting from the Washington Post. Now, me speaking, but in this case, he simply chose to lie. Here's another one, clip number four.
His $1 trillion cuts to our military will eliminate hundreds of thousands of jobs and also put our security at greater risk.
Well, actually, it isn't Obama who proposed trillions of dollars of cuts in our military, although I'm all in favor of them. David Koch yesterday called for cuts in our military, of all people. Of course, he's a libertarian. So, you know, Ron Paul calls for cuts in our military. But the cuts in our military that are supposed to happen at the end of the year were the result of a plan put together by the Republicans, where they said, okay, we're going to have this committee, this super committee that's going to, you know, and we're going to, and if they don't come to some kind of an agreement, then all these cuts are automatically going to kick in. Half of them are going to go to people programs and half of them are going to go to the military. And this, you know, the president was not in favor of this. This was not the Democrats' idea. This was the Republicans' idea. Romney lies again. Here's another one, clip number five.
Unlike President Obama, I will not raise taxes on the middle class of America.
Okay, again, this in the Washington Post today. Overall, Obama has cut taxes broadly for the middle class. He has extended the Bush tax cuts, including making work pay. Obama has called for raising taxes on people making a quarter of $1 million a year, but that's it. So Obama never raised. He says, unlike Obama, I will not raise taxes on the middle class. The fact of the matter is that the largest single tax cut on the middle class, for the middle class, the largest single tax cut for the middle class in the history of the United States was not Ronald Reagan's tax cut. That was for the rich. Was not George Herbert Walker Bush's tax cut. That was for the rich. Wasn't any one of the three of the major ones of George W. Bush's tax cuts. Those were all for rich people. No, the single largest tax cut for working people, for middle class people in the United States, for people making under $100,000 a year, that single largest tax cut was put into place by, promoted by, conceived by, and passed by the Obama administration. Another flat-out lie by Mitt Romney last night. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday. I'm gonna stop ranting here in just a minute. We'll pick up your calls and find out what you're thinking about today, too. Stick around.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school.
Geek.
And proud. Paleoanthropology, how we evolved.
Oh, our geeky science rocks here. Our geeky science for the day. We take just a minute or two and share with you a cool science story. This was in The Guardian. Leading water scientists have found have issued one of the sternest warnings yet about global food supplies, saying that the world's population may have to switch to almost complete vegetarianism over the next 40 years to avoid catastrophic shortages. This is because it takes, you know, tens to thousands of times more water to produce meat than it does to produce vegetables or fruits, because you've got to grow the grain or the food that the animals eat, and that takes a lot of water, and then of course the animals themselves consume a lot of water, and the bottom line, the problem is that we are just plain old flat out running out of fresh water. We had 7 billion, what is it, push on, did we just hit 6 or just hit 7? I think we just hit 6. I can't keep it straight. It's amazing. But whatever it is, we've got a lot of people on this planet right now, and we're looking at the possibility of another 1 or 2 billion population stabilizes, before it levels off. And unless we do something about the way that we eat, we're going to have some serious problems. So I knew when I was 16 years old and I quit eating meat that it was a good idea. I didn't realize it might help save the world. The 7 billion, yeah, so we just hit 7 billion. That was what I thought. Kevin in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
I moved out here to Phoenix about a year ago
mm-hmm.
to go to school. And I'm originally from Burbank, California. And when it came to voting time, you know, even in California, when you see all the people running for public office, you know, you see competitors. You see some Republicans, you see some Democrats. Usually the Democrats win, given I do live in, you know, liberal town California.
Mm-hmm.
However, ever since I've moved out here, I feel like there's a propaganda going on here. Like, there is not one sign for somebody running for public office that says Democrat out here. Everyone is Republican, and I mean everyone. And everyone has a misconception out here, whether they be middle class, lower class, no class, higher class. Everyone is Republican. Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has a sticker on their car saying Obama is Osama or Obama is Hitler or something like that.
Yeah.
And my question is, I wanted to ask Senator Bernie Sanders, but I missed him. What are the Democrats going to do about all this? Like, why aren't they trying to attack this propaganda?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing
going on in the Midwest.
Yeah, what you're seeing is the consequence of two things. It's the power of Fox News, first of all, and secondly, which is the power of a billionaire, Rupert Murdoch, and secondly, it's the power of big money coming from big billionaires who are funding all these AstroTurf groups that produce those signs, that go door to door, that pass that stuff out. They're actually, you know, probably some small fraction, but a measurable fraction, of the reason why the unemployment rate isn't higher is because of all the jobs people have, but being hired by right-wing organizations, doing everything from scrubbing Wikipedia to making phone calls to people to, you know, knocking on doors. I mean, they've got these increasing...
How come those methods aren't working back home, but they're working here?
Well, traditionally, Democrats used unions as their organizing core. And you know, Arizona's a right-to-work-for-less state. You have very few unions in Arizona. And so, you know, the Democratic Party is... And then you also have the problem that Republicans, by their nature, and there's been no shortage of good psychology on this, good studies on this, Republicans, by their nature, are looking for an authority figure to follow. And so they tend to do what they're told, and they tend to go in lockstep. You know, yes, this is our guy. Okay, salute the flag, and on we go. Democrats, on the other hand, tend to be the people in society who ask, hey, wait a minute. You know, the Democrats are the leftovers of the people who founded this country, who said, you know, no, you're going to give a tax break to the British East India Company so it can put all the small tea entrepreneurs out of business? I don't think so. And in 1773, had the Boston Tea Party. So the Democratic Party, which was founded by Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, the Democratic Party it tends to be exactly what Will Rogers described it as, you know, when he famously and funnily said, you know, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And so all of this stuff kind of comes together in what you're seeing. What I would suggest is if you want to see the Democratic Party in your area get more organized, show up for one of their meetings. They are there. They are somewhat organized, and they are looking for help, and they are looking for volunteers. Or beyond that, show up for one of the many grassroots groups that are not affiliated with a political party but are working toward movement, you know, the movement politics groups. ProgressiveDemocratsOfAmerica.org, PDAmerica.org, MoveOn.org, MoveToAmend.org. Howard Dean's DemocracyForAmerica.com. I mean, there's that with Jim Dean's organization. There's a bunch of them out there, good organizations that have local chapters that you can show up at, you can participate with, drinking liberally. You know, just show up at the bar every week and, you know, buy a beer and talk with your friends. There's a lot that can be done, Kevin, without a lot of effort, without a lot of time, you know, time and money, that can start putting a dent in it. And I would recommend doing that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course, of course. I was on the brink of just trying to transfer out of here as soon as I could.
Yeah.
You know, it's not possible.
No, plant a flag and be, you know, hey, I'm going to stand here and, you know, put a bumper sticker on your car and start the trend. Pretty soon, everybody, you know, maybe they'll all start following you and doing what you're doing. Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's Anything Goes Friday. Check out TomHartman.com for free message boards and blogs and all kinds of
stuff. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Not to mention our live chat room where I'm going to drop in right now and say hi. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lee in Duval, Washington, and also hanging out in our chat room. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing these days? Are you missing Oregon?
You know, I love Oregon. And I've lived in a lot of places that I love, and I don't miss any of them. I think of them all fondly, but I try to be happy where I am at the moment. But yeah, I miss Oregon. What can I say?
Okay. Hey, you think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is bad. Do you know about the U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce?
No, I don't.
Well, it's stoked with the neocons, Big Oil, James Baker III, Brzezinski, Sununu, if you go onto their website, you'll see, you know, there's James Baker III, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Kissinger, Scowcroft, John Sununu. That's just the beginning of it.
Wow.
You go over the membership, you're going to see, you're going to just see, you know, oh, Chevron, Conoco, Exxon, Hess Corporation.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just,
well, this is what Azerbaijan has, is they have a hell of a lot of oil.
So they're on the west coast of the Caspian, and of course the Tapi pipeline and the is on the east side. So
right.
What it is back in 1992 there was this section 907 of the Freedom Support Act that was infrastructure that John J. Maresca, when he gave a testimony to Congress in 1998, he's a vice president from Unocal, he wanted them to restore that. In other words, I believe the U.S. tax, I wanted this question for Bernie, by the way, the U.S. taxpayer is being asked by these billionaires to pay for the infrastructure of Azerbaijan so that they can haul their ill-gotten gains out of there. And also, CNN ran a little show the other day, just a quick clip, and then I've never seen it again, that Israel wants to use Azerbaijan as a staging area for imminent attack on Iran.
Hmm.
So I just think we got a lot of problems with this. You know, the neocons, the PNAC, Project for New American Century neocons, have moved into Azerbaijan, and that's where they're going to stage the attack from. That's where they're stealing their resources from. And I would like to know, you know, what your thoughts on all this are.
Yeah, well, what my main thought on it is it's another demonstration of the stupidity of being reliant on foreign oil. We should be in a situation where we can say, okay, we got enough sun, we got enough wind, we got our country solid and secure. We're, you know, producing electric vehicles. We've got good public transportation. We don't need oil from Azerbaijan or anyplace else. And, you know, that's it. End of story. You know, and if they want to cut a deal with Israel, God bless them. But that's not any of our business.
These Republicans are crying so much about our deficit spending and stuff, and yet they don't seem to really bring these things to anybody's attention, that we're spending money in another country while our infrastructure crumbles right here.
Right, and Azerbaijan is not...
Congressional capital is crumbling.
Yeah, and Azerbaijan is not anything close to what you would call a democracy. In fact, if anything, it's a clear example of oligarchy. Excellent point, Lee. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for making it. Ray in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Ray, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. Would you please give comment, in fact, on the goons on the right are promoting the Ryan Medicare plan, that it would not affect persons over the age of 55. But may I please remind you of the 1983 Congress, where the workforce at that time would pay three times more than their predecessors would pay into. Would that not affect persons 55 and younger?
I don't understand what you mean.
The changes that Ryan cares to institute, the Republicans said that it would not affect persons 55 or older.
Right.
It would affect the age group that had paid in three times more than the predecessors, would it not?
Oh, in other words, the younger people right now are paying a higher level of payments into Medicare because Medicare taxes have been going up over the years, and particularly with that big increase that Reagan put through in the 80s. And so what you're saying is that if you're one of those people, you happen to be under 55, but you've been working for 20, 30 years and you've been paying into Medicare, you're going to get screwed. And the answer is yes, exactly. Paul Ryan plans on screwing you. Yep.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you going into detail.
Okay. It's very, very simple stuff. I mean, it's just very simple stuff. And it's all about, you know, it's like, for example, you know, the $716 billion that they say that President Obama took out of Medicare. That was money that Medicare was paying to corporations like United Healthcare, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aetna to get things done for people. So you had a health insurance institution, Medicare, paying a for-profit health insurance company, United Healthcare, to then pay the bills of a for-profit hospital, which was overcharging us. And so what they said was, you know, this is crazy. We could just have Medicare pay the hospital directly. And by the way, we're not going to pay the inflated prices that they had negotiated in these sweetheart deals with the insurance companies. And so, you know, it saved $716 billion over a 10-year period, $71 billion a year roughly. and it saved it to us, the taxpayers. And in fact, there was so much money left over that they were able to close the donut hole, and seniors are paying less for their prescription drugs right now. So Obama saved Medicare with that. And Romney is lying, as the Washington Post pointed out today. Romney, once again, last night, you know, Paul Ryan lied about it the night before last. Romney's lying about it now. They're lying about it on the television ads. And it's mind-boggling. It's really mind-boggling. They apparently think that it's what FDR said. In fact, I want to play this clip again if you can easily grab it, Sean, quickly and easily grab it. Franklin Roosevelt, the long one, the longer one, where he's talking about this little book that this guy wrote that had a suggestion that the Republicans are using. Here it is.
Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself. The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood. Always a big one. For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
There you go. And clearly, the Republican Party has officially adopted Adolf Hitler's suggestion out of Mein Kampf that FDR talked about in 1944 as their campaign strategy. Jesse in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Yeah, I would like to find out how I can get the information or thing to create the stimulus better.
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
Well, you said they used the stimulus to push it back into the infrastructure. And that's how they did it back then.
Information. Sure, yeah. There's probably dozens or hundreds of good history sites, you know, of the post-war era. If you're talking about when Dwight Eisenhower did it, but it's happened. I mean, you know, virtually every president since then. Obama is the one who has been crippled by this. The Republicans refuse to allow him to spend money building infrastructure. And by and large, you know, with the one single exception of that one stimulus bill. But it's common sense. If you build a bridge and it costs you $5 million to build the bridge, and the bridge all of a sudden lets two communities that, you know, weren't engaged in trade with each other before, and now lots and lots of people are using it, and it's going to generate more economic activity. Those people are going to pay taxes, and you're going to make back more than the bridge cost you. That has always been the case with infrastructure in the United States. That's why Abraham Lincoln gave the railroads what would be in today's dollars hundreds of billions of dollars worth of free land and cash to build railroads all across the United States, which led to the great industrial expansion in the post Civil War era in the early 20th century, the early 1900s and 1920s and 1930s. Eisenhower did it again in the 1950s. And then Kennedy did it with NASA. And, you know, hey, let's go to the moon and let's build some infrastructure. And all kinds of really cool inventions came out of that, like the transistor and Velcro and, you know, all kinds of amazing stuff. So it's pretty straightforward stuff, Jesse. It shouldn't be hard to find if you Google around it. I don't have a specific website for it, but you might want to start with the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. That blog, if you look on the economic, they've got an economics part, and you could scroll through. They've got a lot of good charts and graphs there. And you might want to check over on our message board. Somebody might, you know, put up a blog or a message about it, get a conversation going about it, and link out to some of the good sources on it. But again, there's this common sense issue. If a business is going to build a factory, and the factory is going to cost them $1 million, the only reason they're going to build a factory is because they're going to make $2 million from it, right? Similarly, if a government is going to build highways, if they're going to build bridges, if they're going to build schools, they're going to do it because over the long run, they're going to make more back from it. And not just in money. I mean, in social benefits as well, but also in money. That's how stimulus works.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's why when Republicans call it spending, as Mitt Romney did last night, borrowing and spending, they're being disingenuous. They're lying. It's investing. Back, Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars, indeed. And June in Maywood, Illinois. Hey, June, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I really wanted to ask Bernie something, but anyway, your answer said talk to you. The United States is no longer printing U.S. savings bonds. Consequently, elders, a lot of elders are not hooked to a computer, don't know anything about a computer, and cannot buy U.S. savings bonds.
Right.
The people at the bank that I deal with say so many elders are disgusted because they can't buy grandchildren and great-grandchildren United States savings bonds.
Right. My dad used to send those out to his kids and grandchildren for their birthdays, you know.
Well, the Treasury Department says, oh, it's to save money. Well, my question then becomes, how much money are they really saving by denying people the ability to buy them?
Right.
My own kids say they will not put all the information on the computer that is required.
Yeah.
And so what does this Congress or can this Congress, can anybody do about reinstituting the printing of U.S. savings bonds?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, June. It is a good question for Bernie. I would suggest you're in Chicago, or you're in the Illinois, you know, in the Chicago area.
Yeah.
Why don't you contact Dick Durbin? You know, ask his office.
Well, I've done that. I've been through the.
Yeah, and you've contacted both of your senators and your member of the House of Representatives and asked them that question.
Yeah, I've been there, and I just thought maybe the more people I question, the more it gets around.
Okay.
Because I'm sure there's a lot of people in this country.
Raise some rabble. You know, show up at one of the Democratic Party meetings and make the point, too, and tell them, hey, here's a winner for you. Get on this. June, I got to run. We got to thank you very much for the call. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Talk Radio News Report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You could sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at change.org. Ellen Ratner, what's going on?
Okay, well, we just finished with the conventions, and now we're one convention. We're on our way to the second convention. A couple interesting things. First of all, on the Clint Eastwood thing, we are hearing that he had a prepared speech that was vetted, accepted, and he just decided to go his own way.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's interesting. I'm not surprised, frankly, that they, you know, it did surprise me that they would just let him go off prompter. On the other hand, there was nothing on the prompter. So if he had a prepared speech, wouldn't it have been in the prompter?
Perhaps. But, that's just what we heard from sort of the grapevine. I have not totally verified that. They won't verify it with me.
Yeah.
The other thing that came up is this Rule 12. Well, Rule 12, originally, if you want to pick a delegate, the rules were set from convention to convention. Now, by, I think, 3/4 or whatever, I forget what the exact numbers, but members of the Republican National Committee can reset the rules midstream. So, one, they can totally set all the rules in halfway through. They can have another mini convention halfway through.
Right.
And the other thing that they can do is they can also decide at the end, okay, well, so-and-so's got enough delegates, so now we're going to switch all the delegates.
Okay.
So in other words, they take care of the Ron Paul kinds of problems.
Right.
And that's what they decided to do, and there were tons of people protesting that yesterday.
If the Republicans, I don't know if you caught the Rachel Maddow piece where she basically broke down, you know, what the electorate was and how Romney had 0% of the black vote and a very, very small percentage of the Hispanic vote, all this kind of thing. And then basically the only way they can win is if they can get more than 61% or 63%, 65% of the white vote. And so all of Romney's efforts from today forward or from, you know, weeks ago forward have been to simply get the white vote. Now, Paulistas, the Ron Paul followers, tend to be, by and large, white people. And I'm wondering if by alienating them and basically, you know, patting them on the head and then kicking them out of the party, if the Republicans are hurting their ability to win the election. What do you think?
I think that's a brilliant analysis, as you usually do, and I think that that may be very, very true. I'll tell you, when Condoleezza Rice was speaking, C-SPAN focused on the African-Americans in the crowd,
mm-hmm.
and there weren't many of them. But if you saw it on TV and you were watching C-SPAN, you would get a very different impression than what I saw.
Yeah, you were there, and you could see that the audience was almost entirely white.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A couple other interesting things. One major interesting thing. In 2004, I was watching the POTUS. I was in New York. I was actually retired, so I went back home. And I watched I was watching the entire proceedings, and Shalene said to me, "Oh my gosh, that podium looks like a cross." So the next day, I asked my friend Mark Feifley, who was he was the spokesperson for the convention, and he got all flustered. You know, he was upset,
mm-hmm.
but he's my friend, so what's he gonna do? And then I said something to the guy at BeliefNet, who thought I was crazy, but then decided I wasn't crazy. And then the Jewish folks got upset. Well, if you look at the podium from last night, it looks very much like the main podium place where the Mormon Tabernacle choir sings and the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City. Now, some people think it has the beehive design. I tend to think that. Some people disagree. But there's no question, if you just put the two pictures side by side, I don't know if it's on your website. It is on talkradionews.com website, our website. But if you took the two, I think it's pretty...
I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, Mitt Romney is part of a religion that is fairly... What did you say, Sean? Is part of a religion that is fairly superstitious. And you know, I mean, all the secret numbers and, you know, the Masonic stuff. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had, you know, good Mormons come in and come out with sacred architecture for it. So I think you're right, Ellen. I think you're right. Thanks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. I want to remind you that on the evening of the inauguration of Barack Obama, January 20th, 2009, the evening of the inauguration, in a very fancy, schmancy restaurant favored by lobbyists here in town, the Caucus Room. In fact, it was on the backside of the building that Louise and I were living in at the time. Not at that time, actually. We lived there a year later, but I'm familiar with the restaurant. That on the evening of that inauguration, there was a meeting in that restaurant of, I believe it's a total of 16 or 17 Republicans. And what these Republicans agreed to do at this meeting... Now, keep in mind, at this point in time, on January 20th, 2009, we were losing 750,000 jobs per month. The day that Barack Obama was sworn into office. And what these Republicans committed to each other that they would do to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president was to block any efforts for him to take unemployment below 8%. To make the economy work, to help people out with their housing, to help people out with their jobs, that they would block all those efforts. 2 months after this covert meeting, March of 2009, Congressman Pete Sessions said Republicans should follow the model of the Taliban. Here's exactly what he said. It was an interview with National Journal. He said, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire program or processes. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. The other side, of course, being the Democratic Party. He went on to say, if the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities that we want, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out, be prepared to see things further what they are rather than trying to do something about them. At the meeting, Representative Kevin McCarthy said, we've got to challenge them on every single bill. We have to show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. Now, let me remind you that one of the men at that meeting, and they were all men, one of the men at that meeting was Paul Ryan. This is a meeting of traitors, of men who were conspiring to commit treason against the United States to cripple a presidency for political purposes. They had all voted, every single one of the people in that room. Here's the list. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, and then they were hosted by Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. Here's how they all voted. They all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney January 2008 stimulus and tax cut. They all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney bailing out of Bear Stearns. They all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney bailing out of IAG. They all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney TARP in September of 2008, and they all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney second TARP of October of 2008. All of these same Republicans had supported Bush-Cheney keeping the cost of the two wars off the budget. In other words, put it on the corporate credit card or put it on the nation's credit card. And they supported Bush-Cheney spending $4 trillion while giving the top 1% tax cuts. They all supported that. Every one of these members of Congress have participated in threatening to shut down the government over things like raising the debt ceiling. They're still threatening it. Senator in the Senate, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, the guys who were at that meeting on the evening that Barack Obama was sworn into office at the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., where these traitors met. With Paul Ryan. They filibustered more than 300 pieces of legislation, more than any other Congress in the history of the United States. And they voted no on every single piece of legislation brought to the floor that would have advanced the president's agenda, including no to Al Franken's anti-rape amendment, no on Lilly Ledbetter, no on Fair Pay Act, no on an outsourcing bill, an anti-outsourcing bill. Representatives Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren in the House of Representatives voted no on every single piece of legislation, again, you know, Obama legislation, including no on increasing FEMA during natural disasters. They have been making, this is the 3.5-year effort to sabotage the U.S. economy. Mitt Romney last night started out his speech by saying that we all had great hopes for President Obama. We wanted to see him succeed. America comes together at times like this. It was a lie. It was perhaps the worst and most egregious lie of the entire evening. Because the fact of the matter is that his vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, sat in this meeting with these other men, these other Republicans, on the evening of the inauguration in January 20, 2009 of the President of the United States. They sat in a private room at the Caucus Room restaurant, and they conspired to create to make life hell for the American middle class over the next 4 years so that Barack Obama would get blamed for it and Republicans could come riding in on their white horse, which is what they're trying to do right now. In fact, as after the meeting was over, Newt Gingrich, who had been at that meeting, the only two unelected people who were at that meeting were Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich said after this four-hour dinner on January 20th, he said that, quote, "You'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown." Literally plotting to sabotage the United States. Paul Ryan and his merry band. We must remind ourselves of this every day. That these men conspired to make life hell for working people in the United States, to keep unemployment up, to keep student loans up, to prevent people from getting jobs, to continue the horrors of outsourcing. We've lost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years. They conspired to continue this throughout the Obama administration so that Obama and the Democrats would take the blame for it. And we have seen this in filibuster after filibuster after filibuster and hold on legislation after hold on legislation and hold after hold on legislation. Some great bills that were passed out of the House back when Nancy Pelosi was running it those first 2 years that would have put America back on the course of economic recovery, substantial economic recovery. But these traitors conspired explicitly. As Newt Gingrich said, you will look back on this day and see the seeds of 2012. Conspired explicitly to bring down the Obama presidency and the Democratic Party by blocking any kind of significant forward progress or progressive motion. And they continue to this very day. And that's why I think the biggest lie of all last night that Mitt Romney told was that he and all the Republicans were hoping that Obama would succeed. No, they were not only hoping he'd fail, they were planning on it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, Rush Limbaugh at least had the cojones to come out and say that he bluntly hoped Obama would fail. The rest of these guys, no, they're weasels.
I'm a robot man who can't quite talk. The trees are high, the pancakes warm. I've been a privileged son since I was born. But now I'm full of lies. It's okay. The truth will go the other way. You don't have to understand the New York Times with Fox News, man. Whether you're a Mormon or whether you're a Mormon, I'm saying a lie. Saying a lie. Feel my door shaking and everything is faking. I'm saying a lie. Saying a lie. Lie, 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 lie. Saying a lie.
Well, that's been the history of Mitt Romney's entire political career, is to, you know, lick his finger, lift it into the wind and see which way the wind is blowing and say whatever, you know, it seems to be. Mitt Romney was, I mean, we've got to get some of those clips, Shane. They're out there. They play them on TV all the time, you know, where Mitt Romney's saying things like, you know, I believe in a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. And I believe that, you know, we've got too many guns and weapons on our streets and we should have gun control I'm proud to have Romney Care, you know, this health care for all. Everybody should have the right to, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mitt Romney is a guy with no core values. This is a guy who wants to be president of the United States because his daddy wanted to be president of the United States and because he thinks that, and his church thinks, that destiny has ordained a Mormon to become president of the United States, and he's the guy. And those aren't, in my mind, the best reasons to be president of the United States. I think that people should want to be president of the United States because they want to do what's best for the American people. And if Romney actually wanted to do what was best for the American people, A, he wouldn't have a traitor like Paul Ryan on his ticket with him. And B, he would be telling us what he's going to do. Because that's how we're supposed to make our decisions. What are you going to do? Oh, well, that sounds good. Okay, I'll vote for you. Patricia in Keene, Texas. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Mitt Romney
keeps saying he's going to create millions of jobs. And my question is, what kind of jobs is he claiming he's going to create? Are these jobs some that will help push through the doors of freedom from fossil fuels, or jobs that will line the fat cat pockets and leave us all with nothing more than a dead planet and worthless paper in our pockets?
Right.
I mean,
I don't believe that he even has a rational plan to create jobs. I mean, you know, here's his 5-point plan. Okay, clip number 9. Here's the first point on energy.
Paul Ryan and I have 5 steps. First, by 2020, North America will be energy independent by taking full advantage of our oil, our coal, our gas, our nuclear, and our renewables.
Now, did you notice he said North America? He didn't say the United States of America. So, in other words, we're going to start buying a lot more oil from Canada with the Keystone XL pipeline and from Mexico. So I don't know how that's going to create jobs. I have no idea how that's going to create jobs. I know it's going to make Canada and Mexico a lot richer. His second point, number 2.
Second, we'll give our fellow citizens the skills they need for the jobs of today and the careers of tomorrow. When it comes to the school your child will attend, every parent should have a choice and every child should have a chance.
So school vouchers, in other words. So I don't know how school vouchers create jobs. Again, you've got, you know, a certain number of kids who need to be educated, a certain number of teachers to do it, whether they're working for a private for-profit corporation or whether they're working for a school district. You know, I don't see where that's going to make jobs. Here's clip 11. This is his
third. We'll make trade work for America by forging new trade agreements.
Right. That trade stuff has really worked out really well ever since Richard Nixon first opened the doors to China, hasn't it? Free trade is just exactly what we need, more corporate free trade. His fourth point.
And fourth, to assure every entrepreneur and every job creator that their investments in America will not vanish as have those in Greece, we will cut the deficit and put America on track to a balanced budget.
Yeah, balanced budget. You know, United States has never had a balanced budget since the George Washington administration. We did once back, I think it was during the Andrew Jackson administration. It was in the 1830s or thereabouts. We paid off the deficit, the debt rather. And what happened? We had a recession. In fact, we had a Great Depression. The debt and deficit are not problems. They are not problems. I mean, they are issues, the things that we need to be addressed, and they have nothing to do with creating jobs. So here's his fifth point.
And fifth, we will champion small businesses, America's engine of job growth. That means reducing taxes on business, not raising them. It means simplifying and modernizing the regulations that hurt small business the most. And it means that we must rein in the skyrocketing cost of health care by repealing and replacing Obamacare.
Okay, so he's going to cut taxes on rich people. He's already said he's going to raise taxes on people making under $60,000 a year. He's going to cut taxes on people making over $1 million a year. He's going to have less regulation. So he's going to say to the Koch brothers or to the oil refineries, hey, you know, that mercury that you're scrubbing out with your scrubbers right now, you don't have to do that anymore. That's actually going to lose jobs. I don't know how that's going to create jobs. Regulation creates jobs. You could argue that they're not good jobs or they shouldn't be there or the regulations are bad or wrong or whatever. I mean, you can argue that all day long. But the fact of the matter is that when the government says, okay, canning company, you have to have a contraption at the end of your assembly line that checks every single can of tomatoes that goes out to make sure that they don't have salmonella bacteria. Somebody's got to manufacture that detector. Somebody has to install that detector. Somebody has to monitor. It creates jobs. Pretty much any regulation you can think of creates jobs. So as far as I can tell on all 5 of his points, he's going to cut jobs and impose European-style austerity in the United States. That's working out really well in Europe right now. The continent as a whole has an unemployment rate two full points higher than the United States. Why? Because we had Barack Obama who did a stimulus, and they are all listening to the old devotees of Milton Friedman and the crazy people from the IMF. So anyhow, back to your calls in just a second. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes, Fred.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we will be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God's gone. Anything goes.
Anything goes. Welcome back. Hey, Gus in Houston, Texas. What's on your mind today, Gus?
Tom, I love you like a brother, but I've got a slight bone to pick with you.
Go for it.
Okay, the other day I was having a debate with a rabid T-Billy, and we were debating capitalism, and I told him I'm an artist, and he said, well, you're a capitalist. You invest in your business. And I said, no, I'm an artist. I know a ballet dancer, but she has to buy tutus and slippers, but she doesn't call herself a capitalist. Mm-hmm. So technically, isn't a capitalist someone who invests money to make money?
Yes, a capitalist is someone who employs capital, in other words, invests, and then lives off the return on that capital. And there's probably fewer than 10 or 20,000 real capitalists in the United States, a fairly small number of people who actually just live off their investments.
That was my argument, because I've heard you say that. And I said there are probably, you know, around 10 or 20,000 people who are true capitalists. They invest money to make money. And
right.
He said, no, you invest money in your business.
No, you're an entrepreneur.
But, you know, I looked up the dictionary definition, and basically what it said was someone who invests money in a business to, you know, I know what you're saying, but
yeah.
If
you invest money in your own business, Gus, and your business grows to the point where it's doing really, really well, and you retire, and you just start living off the dividends that business is throwing off, at that point you become a capitalist.
Okay,
up until that point, you were an entrepreneur. I don't have any idea what the dictionary says, but I can tell you. I mean, you go back to read, you know, Wealth of Nations in 1776. Read David Ricardo's On Capital in 1810. Read, you know, read the classics of, you know, read John Maynard Keynes or John Kenneth Galbraith. You know, any textbook on economics will agree with what I'm telling you.
That's a great point about it, calling yourself an entrepreneur rather than a capitalist, because that makes perfect sense. But this debate really bothers me, because we've got so many people brainwashed in America. We've become a bunch of peasants who are fighting for the very people who are screwing us.
Yeah, you're right. And that's the way they want it, by the way.
It's amazing how well it works, how easy it is for them to turn half the country into a bunch of the proletariat. You know, like you say, they consider themselves a bunch of inconvenience millionaires.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Gus, thanks a lot for the call.
Tom, we love you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. I hope you can win the argument next time. Howard in Miami, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Just a quick note. I was watching, I think it was Martin Bashir, and he had an economist on from one of the prior administrations, Jared, and he said that 12 million jobs are what's expected to be generated in the economy over the next 4 years in any event. So the pledge by Romney to create 12 million jobs doesn't really mean much.
That would be, it's a 250,000 jobs a month, and right now the economy is generating around 125,000 jobs a month. So, you know, what Romney's claiming is going to do is really not all that great shakes. And in fact, it would be happening right now if this little cabal of Republican congressmen led by Paul Ryan that met the night that Barack Obama was inaugurated, this little cabal of traitors had not said and put into place and done their obstruction of absolutely everything that the Obama administration wanted to do to put America back to work.
You know, the thing that I can't understand is it seems to me that the answer to some of these things is so simple. For instance, this claim that Obama's policies haven't worked. I mean, for me, I would start out with an ad with Mitch McConnell saying his job is number one job is to make Obama one-term president. And then I have a quote from Draper from, you know, "Ask Not What Good We Do."
Right.
And then I would just list every act, how many jobs it would have created, and blocked by the Republicans. And I just list them all. And people, these are the facts. So it doesn't have to be complicated.
I am expecting that those are the kinds of ads that we will be seeing. I am hoping that those are the kinds of ads that we will be seeing. And I think that those are the kind of ads that the Republicans were trying to neutralize in advance by saying, all they've got is to blame other people. In other words, they're blaming us, right? Well, they're blaming you because you're the guys who are responsible for it. And not you, Howard, of course, but the Republicans. And I think that they were trying to head that off. Howard, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius. David, listening on WWRL in, what is it, Suffern, New York?
We're all suffering and suffering.
Okay, so what's up?
Just a call. I mean, I'm calling in response to something you were saying earlier when it comes to, you know, the bridges and building infrastructure. And, you know, I'll also cite something you were saying. I shouldn't say cite, but you were saying that we shouldn't worry about the deficit and such. I mean, sales manager, I'm always worried about return on investment. Once again, you say we're going to generate revenue on highways, connected communities.
Well, actually, the major investment that the Obama administration wanted to make was light rail and high-speed rail, which is like, you know, the 21st century version of highways. Highways were very 19th century or 20th century.
Because you were saying highways earlier.
Yeah, well, we need to repair them.
Transportation
yeah.
of goods. And
sure.
Same thing with railway. I mean, transportation goods, you're looking at manufacturing, and the current mindset of what's going on is small business. Small business is not some investment.
It must be a VoIP phone, David. I'm losing about every other word you're saying. Can you summarize your question or your statement really briefly, please?
What I was saying was, can you hear me better now?
Yeah. Hello? No, now I can't hear you at all. I'm sorry. It's just not working. Randall in San Antonio. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. Hey, I just kind of wanted to make a point. I'm actually a conservative. I do listen to your show from time to time. You made the comment about Ryan and this group of people that are wrecking Obama's policies. But if that's the case, then how did Obama ever get Obamacare passed? How did he get his stimulus passed? If you had a group of people that were responsible for wrecking the policy.
That's a very good question. The way that he got the stimulus passed, the way that he got the Obamacare passed, is the way that the Republicans are saying that they're going to get everything they want done passed if they get control of the United States Senate. And it's through what's called budget reconciliation. Budget reconciliation, it's how George W. Bush got his tax cuts passed. If you call a bill that originates in the House of Representatives and then goes to the Senate, if you call it a budget bill, then it cannot be filibustered. If, on the other hand, you call it a law or a policy or a program, it can be filibustered. And so the big mistake that the Democrats made, in my opinion, over the last 3 years, in particular the last 2 years, is they didn't roll everything into budget bills and get them out of the House so that they couldn't be filibustered in the Senate. And Grover Norquist, it wasn't on the front page, it was inside, but I read this in the Financial Times 2 days ago. I did a daily take rant about it on our TV show last night. Grover Norquist has said that what the Republicans are going to do is every piece of legislation that they want to get through, whether it has to do with abortion or whether it has to do with birth control or whether it has to do with food stamps or whether it has to, no matter what it has to do with, every piece of legislation that they get through, they are going to label it a budget bill so that it only takes 51 votes in the Senate. And what the Obama administration did, and they're going to pass it through reconciliation. The Obama administration did that with Obamacare. Obamacare will expire in 10 years. This is the downside of reconciliation is that nothing can last more than 10 years if it's done this way. And that's why the Bush tax cuts were supposed to automatically expire 2 years ago, and they got extended. Was because they were passed by reconciliation. Making sense?
Okay.
I realize it's arcane, weird.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the explanation on that. You know, another thing is that, you know, that seems to correlate is a lot of people, and this is both sides, we're in a very polarizing political world these days.
Yes, we are.
Either one way or the other, and I don't like it, but this is a side I've chosen for different reasons. But anyway, you know, a lot of the economic issues seem to correlate with when the Democrats took control of the House and Senate, but it doesn't seem to be convenient to talk about that. It seems to be convenient to shift back to who was the president. And I think ultimately the president doesn't control the economy. I mean, you know, to suggest that one person can control the whole national economy is, I think, a little bit short-sighted.
Well, the president does have the bully pulpit, but you know, according to our Constitution, Congress controls the economy. All taxing and spending has to originate in the House of Representatives. Section Article 1, Section 8, I think it's paragraph 1 of Section 8.
Well, that's more than I know right there. But what I'm saying is, you know, a lot of people talk about the economy, you know, going downhill when Bush was in office, and that is true, but that also correlated with when the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's...
You know what it mostly correlated with?
Nobody wants to...
What it mostly correlated with was that we had this housing bubble that had been growing for about a decade that was in large part the consequence of Alan Greenspan saying... And he, you know, you'll recall, he famously came forward and apologized for this and said I was wrong. He was operating out of this Ayn Rand theory that markets are perfect, that markets ultimately always correct themselves, and that business people will always make the best decisions because they're worried about their reputations. And so he was doing this super easy money thing that was letting people, and then, of course, you had in 99 and 2000, and these were the last years of the Clinton administration, Phil Gramm pushing through Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. And what they did, what those laws did, was they allowed the banksters to take mortgages. First of all, they allowed them to start giving mortgages to anybody without any regulation whatsoever, whoever they wanted, so you could have liar loans. And then secondly, they allowed them to go from zero to $800 trillion. Keep in mind, the GDP of the entire world is $65 trillion a year. From zero to $800 trillion worth of derivatives, bets on bets on bets on bets, that were created as a consequence of this deregulation. And that all came to an end in 2008.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Actually, it didn't come to an end. The bubble popped. It really popped in 2007. That's when the housing bubble popped, and then the stock market bubble popped in 2008.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, who is in the next week or so going to be doing her very last chemo. Thank God. To our executive producer, Sean Taylor. To our associate producer, Shane Farnan. Our video director, Jim Javinsky, phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to writer, researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the people at the various companies that syndicate this program. Dial Global syndicates us on commercial stations coast to coast. Pacifica Radio syndicates us on nonprofit stations, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV. And all the, oh boy, somebody needs to bring me a glass of water quick. And all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country. All the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture. To our newsletter editors, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room. Hey, to you, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service. To Jay Tamboli for tech support. To our affiliates, our sponsors. And to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Tip to future talk show hosts. Do not eat salad during the breaks and have nothing to drink. Because little pieces get stuck in your throat. Thank you, Jim. Oh, my goodness. What a relief. Okay, my apologies. Anything Goes is not supposed to include that. My sincere apologies. Steve in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was looking at the census data and saw that the least populous 25 states accounts for 1/6 of the U.S. population, yet those 25 states get, you know, 50 senators. And when you look at which states they are, you know, the majority of them are small Republican states. So
yes,
it seems to me the agenda has been hijacked by the way our system is set up. Otherwise, you know, the people and Obama could have gotten their way much more if it weren't for an obstructionist Senate that comes from these small states.
You're right. You're right. And this is and the solution to this, in my mind, is fairly straightforward. Break California into three states. Southern, you know, Tex-Mex would be the southern part, then Los Angeles, you know, San Diego south, and then the Los Angeles area, and then San Francisco north, right? Break California into three states. Break Texas into two states. Break Florida into two states, north and south. Break New York State into two states. Make one of them Manhattan and the five boroughs and the other the rest of the state. And if you did that, you would then have a solid two-thirds majority Democratic Senate, first of all, and secondly, you would have a much more representative form of government. It ain't going to happen.
What if we give each state one senator and then proportion the rest based on population or something like that?
Yeah, that's not going to happen. That would require major changes in our Constitution. What I'm suggesting are things that the individual states could do. And that wouldn't require changes in the Constitution. It would just require the states to do them. Although I doubt that, you know, you're going to find the California legislature all that amenable to breaking itself in three pieces. But it would be the best thing for the nation. Frankly, I think it would be the best thing for California. They could reboot a whole awful lot of things. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my forum. Glad you're back feeling well. Don't choke on anything now. But anyway, I'd like to discuss Paul Ryan and his Medicare plan, and Medicare as we know it. And obviously we know this is a political liability and vulnerability for the Republican presidential ticket, but yet when Democrats attack the Ryan plan, and rightfully so, they wrongly allow Ryan to get the most message, with Democrats getting lost in the weeds and details of who cuts what for Medicare, and with Democrats being put on the defensive about Obamacare. But I think instead Democrats need to stay focused and get back to talking about the Ryan Care plan to completely privatize and to end Medicare as we know it and to shortchange Medicare beneficiaries.
Yeah.
With this inadequate
Jerry, I completely agree with you. Here's the big problem that we have. The big problem that we have is that the other side is willing to lie through their teeth. What do you do when the other side is willing to say President Obama stole $716 billion out of Medicare and again put it in Obamacare? It's not true. It's a lie. The Washington Post this morning called it out as a lie. They say Mitt Romney keeps repeating it. We keep pointing it out. It's a lie. But, you know, I mean, it's what do you do when the other side is willing to use Hitler's big lie strategy?
Here's what I would do. If I had done, I would say, look, we can talk about cuts to Medicare all we want. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is that we progressive Democrats, we want to keep and preserve and protect Medicare as we know it for all generations.
No, I'm with you, Jerry. And in fact, we should be pointing out that it was Lyndon Johnson who created Medicare. And it was the Democrats who created it. It was the Republicans who fought it tooth and nail. It was Ronald Reagan who said it was going to doom us. And do you still have that Franklin Roosevelt clip up? One last time, FDR calling out the Republicans.
Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf.
Mein Kampf.
Written by Hitler himself.
Written by Hitler himself.
The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood.
Never use a small falsehood.
Always a big one.
Always a big one.
For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
There you go. And that was Franklin Roosevelt calling out the Republicans for using the big lie technique in the 1940s. And here they are doing it again. Coming up Monday, the RNC convention's behind us. Now it's on to Charlotte for the Democratic convention. We'll have all the news from the convention floor. Plus, we'll have Teamsters President James Hoffa, Christine Pelosi, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Senator Sherrod Brown, a whole bunch of other guests, and the best of the rest of the news, along with your calls, right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And remember, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.